Oh my God, I'm so nervous. Osio, hello. Hold on, I just got to take a second because there's a lot of people here and this makes me a little paranoid. Right? Oh, you might get shot then. Jilugi, Aki Nugiwi, Ya, Jini Ne Li, Wadu, Onekwa. And I just said, welcome, my friends, my people, as if I was directing you as my own tribe. And I just thanked my creator for letting me be up here because I am truly honored to be at this convention and to be a part of Cocaine Anonymous. Let's see what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Houma, Louisiana. Oh, I'm Allison. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Did I, like, get that far? I'm also ADHD, so I'm really not sure where this whole thing's going to go today, but it could go in some numerous ways. I was born in Houma, Louisiana, and I grew up a little different than most people, you know. My mom was going to school to be a nurse, you know. My parents had been married for 7 years when they had me. However, my dad was not exactly like the most pleasant of all men when I was growing up. I was the apple of his eye, so I was completely spoiled as a child, but he was not the nicest of guys. And so he actually did a lot of things with like running chop shops and you know, drug runner. And, you know, I grew up with people playing cards, sitting at a table with sawed-off shotguns and, you know, bags of weed. And that's how it was. You know, my dad totally changed his life around probably when I was like 7 or 8. But I learned at a very young age that, can you guys hear me okay? Because I can speak louder. I got no problems there. So anyway, I learned at a very young age that you could get whatever you wanted by the abuse of money, power, and drugs. And so, you know, I grew up relatively, like, after my dad had kind of cleaned everything up, we had moved to Minnesota. My dad called himself a migrant aircraft worker because the industry in Louisiana had gone bust, and so we moved up to Minnesota, and he started working for Northwest Airlines. And we lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul area for a while, and then we moved over to Bay City, Wisconsin, which is where the squirrels are. Yeah. Probably when I was a teenager was when, you know, I started kind of dabbling in and out with drugs, and you know, I started out with marijuana, and that just, I don't know. Well, I'm allergic to it too, so it didn't go all that well, but I didn't know that at the time. I just kind of kept using the, you know, thinking that it was going to be different, like the insanity of it. And so, anyways, so I had started out with marijuana and then had switched to cocaine and later on methamphetamines, you know. And I went on to graduate high school to go into the military. I was a productive member of the military. I was good at my job. I was good at what I did. I was nuclear, biological, chemical, weapons of mass destruction. Go Army, right? Bet you all feel safe. Because here I am. Wow. Anyway, so yeah, I was a productive member of the armed forces, all high on meth and drinking every night and functioning like a human being, going to work, you know. And it was kind of crazy because for the longest time I was living this double life, you know. I was model citizen kind of by day, and at night, I mean, I was pushing meth from St. Paul down to wherever else I went, you know, Red Wing, Bay City. It was sheer insanity, and it was very difficult to keep up with. Oh, yeah, the other thing, I was going to school at the time. maybe that's part of the ADHD. I mean, you can do multiple things at one time, like live different lives, but whatever. Anyways, so, you know, I was doing all of these things, and then the crazy part to me was, you know, I had all these stipulations set up, you know. I had it figured out. I figured you couldn't be a drug addict until you were 30, because 30 is kind of that cutoff where you know. And I figured you couldn't exactly be an alcoholic until you were 35, you know. So according to my calculations, I had like 8 years left to use and 13 years left to drink. And so I was like, I was pretty convinced that I was way too young to be a drug addict or alcoholic. You know, I had a very different opinion of what that was, you know. I didn't realize at the time that this disease does not discriminate against age, you know. It doesn't discriminate against race, social class. It doesn't discriminate against anything. And, you know, I remember looking at my dad's side of the family, and I have a couple uncles that I had looked at, and I didn't ever want to be like them. You know, I didn't ever want to be the drunk that was fighting people in the bar. I didn't want to be the one that was stealing from my family. And I didn't want to be the one that was going to walk out on my family like my uncles had, you know. And the more I used, the more I turned into them. And I sat back and literally watched that go on. And there was nothing that I could do about it, you know, because my addiction had had me so wrapped up in everything, you know. And here I was, you know, trying to put, like, the whole military shit into it, you know, the 90% mental, the 10% physical. So really, I should be able to figure this out, you know. But drugs and alcohol had me baffled to where I couldn't figure it out. You know, that 90% mental with methamphetamines and cocaine was totally gone because I had a one-track mind at that point, you know, and I didn't care who I had to hurt to get it, and whether it meant hurting myself or whatever. Okay. So I was 20. I had turned 21 years old. This is, you know, kind of how bad things had sort of gotten. I turned 21 in October, and then by January, like, I remember spending New Year's that year, and I was like, this year is going to be so different. That was on New Year's Eve. By the 4th of January, I was sitting in jail for a whole weekend with a DWI, a possession of methamphetamines, a possession of paraphernalia to ingest a controlled substance, like, intent to deliver. It was just, I was like, and I remember waking up in the jail cell in good old Pierce County, Wisconsin, and I was sitting there and I was thinking to myself, yeah, this is a great fucking year. You know, that's all I could honestly think. And so you would think that, you know, with that little, you know, wake up, that things would have changed at that point. And that actually took me a year and a half after that to actually switch things around. The last time I had gone to jail, I had gotten arrested over in Lake City, Minnesota. I was actually arrested at one of my friend's house who decided to be a little jerk and call the police because he was mad at me. And so it took 8 police officers to get me down, and I remember getting tackled in the living room, and I was just insane. And I looked up, and here's my friend's daughter standing there looking at me crying. And I somehow talked this cop into, you know, I was like, okay, look, I promise you that if you just let me walk out of here without these handcuffs and wait to do it on the porch, I won't run and I won't say anything else. And even though I was, you know, a liar, manipulator, whole nine yards, for some reason, even when I was using, keeping my word was kind of, you know, I may not show up at the time that I was supposed to, but, you know, if I was in for it and I was caught, I was going to keep my word to you, you know. And so he actually let me walk out the door, and I graciously got into the squad car, you know. I had gotten moved around for a while between jails and from Minnesota back into Wisconsin, because by that point I had this whole fugitive from justice thing going on, because they don't really like it when you skip out on your probation and just tell your PO that, you know what, I quit, you know? apparently that wasn't in the probation parole rules. There was kind of a breach of contract on my part, but whatever. So I had gotten extradited back to Wisconsin, and I sat out my time until I had gone to court. The point where I realized that there was definitely issues was I had sat in jail all this time. My dad was in the hospital. He had fallen 20 feet out of a tree. We weren't sure if he was going to make it. He had broken all of his ribs on his right-hand side, 2 cervical vertebrae, punctured his lungs, internal bleeding, the whole 9 yards. And I got out of jail, and I was high by that night because I didn't know how else to deal with everything. I was let out for 3 weeks to get my affairs in order. I remember being in the courtroom, and I was sitting there with my lawyer, and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to fucking revoke myself. Jeez, I swear a lot. I'm really sorry. The F word is my favorite, and I don't mean to say it up here because I don't, but it just kind of slips. But anyway, I remember sitting in the courtroom, and I'm sitting there with my lawyer, and I was like, I just need to revoke myself. That's what I really need to do. I just need to sit out the rest of my time, because my head, I was so sick that I was thinking, if I just sat out my time and I went to prison, I could still use there. And when I get out, I would be free and clear of all paper, and I could be high, you know? And I remember the judge saying, you know, that's not going to happen for you. Actually, what's going to go on is we're going to make treatment a part of your sentence. And I was like, I looked over at my lawyer and I said, can he do that? And he said, he's the judge, he can do whatever he wants. And I was like offended. I was like, do you know who I am? Oh my God, I was so important, you know? And anyway, so I was like sitting there thinking the whole time, this is great. This is like my worst nightmare, because I didn't know who I was going to be without drugs. You know, I didn't know who I was going to be without alcohol. I had no clue. I never once did it cross my mind that this could be like the greatest thing ever. That was not it, you know. To me, I had been to one meeting or a couple meetings before this, and it was another fellowship, but I thought AA people were icky. Like, I didn't want to hug anybody, and I didn't want to touch anybody, and I remembered that first meeting because I knew if I went to treatment, I was going to have to go to them damn meetings. I wasn't like those people, you know? I had this guy at my first meeting ever. He was like, we got done, and my dad had gone with me, and I was sitting there, and he was like, can I get a hug? And I was like, no. No, you can't. And then my dad's like, give the damn man a hug. He wants a hug. So I give this old dude a hug. I mean, he's like old. And he says, I like getting hugs from young girls. That was it. I was done. I was done with 12 steps. I was done with meetings. I was not dealing with that again. And so when I was sitting in court and I was thinking, oh my God, I have to go to treatment. That means I have to go to meetings, and that means I have to hug people. And the reality of it was, it wasn't that I wanted to hug. It wasn't that those people were icky. It was, I didn't feel worthy enough. I didn't feel like I was good enough to get that hug, and I didn't feel like I was good enough to be sitting at that table with those people. You know, I wasn't a happy camper when I came through the meetings of 12, you know, the doors of 12-step programs. I was pissed off. You know, I showed up on a court order angry as shit, and it drove me crazy because I had to sit there and be like, hi, my name's Allison, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and everybody would be like, hi, Allison, all chipper and cheery, and it drove me crazy for months, you know? Anyway, so I realized how powerless I was at the point where, you know, here's my dad in the hospital. My 15-year-old sister is pregnant. Like, yeah. My mom is running around our yard with a white pillowcase written on it, "I surrender, God." Not kidding. My mom had lost her mind. She was going to Al-Anon. Running around the yard because I was using, my sister was knocked up, my dad was in the hospital, and she was waving a pillowcase like a mad woman in the yard saying, "God, I surrender." And I just sat there and I was like, all right, people think I'm crazy. I'm high and I'm not doing that, you know? I mean, that's all I could think about. But anyways, so my dad gets out of the hospital. He's doing better. And I go to treatment. I'm on my way to treatment in handcuffs. It's a six-month inpatient program. And I remember just going on a welcome home, Allison, goodbye, Allison, having this great big party for myself because, you know, I was going to treatment. And it just made sense at the time. But anyway, and I remember being like, you know, that you've slept, but you're not really all that happy about everything because your body is jonesing out sort of deal. And I'm in handcuffs on my way to this treatment facility, and these POs are sitting there and like, this is a great place. You're going to love it here. Really? Really? How about you go there and live there for 6 months, send me a postcard and tell me how well it's going for you, and I'll see if I decide to go there. Anyway, they drop me off. They dropped me off there, and I was just debating. Like, I was sitting there thinking, I should really run. I should leave. I shouldn't even be sitting here because I'm not like these people. I was so divinely unique. It was just crazy. And I don't know what changed, and I don't know why I stayed there, but that was kind of like the turning point of everything, you know? That was where I had actually enough time off of drugs and alcohol to actually sit down and look at my life, you know, and realizing that, yes, I absolutely was powerless, that life was completely unmanageable. You know, here I was getting out of jail. My biggest concern should have been my dad, and it was not, you know. It was drugs, you know, and that was where things started to change, you know. And I had, like, kind of a hard time, too, with, you know, steps two and three were really difficult for me because I had grown up Catholic, and I'm now like recovering Catholic. So I, anyways, totally different ballgame, but I was used to the punishing God. I was used to, if you don't do this the right way, you're going to hell. You know, and I figured that, you know, I had done enough shitty stuff in my life that I was already on my way there. So what's the point in changing it, you know? And I remember I get stuck in this room with my roommate. She had like 80s bangs. She had mall bangs. I mean, they were like, and they went all the way down the side of her head. And she was like chipper and crazy and totally nuts. And she kept telling me, "Allison, you need to find Jesus. You need to find God. You need a higher power." And I was like, okay. So I had this handheld Yahtzee game when I was in treatment. It kind of occupied my time a little bit. And I remember looking at her one night, and she had just gone on this big Jesus lecture, and I listened to part of it, and I was like, okay, seriously? I just finally looked at her, and I was like, you know what? If your God is real, if there is something that great out there, they're going to help me win this Yahtzee game, so shut up, you know? So all of a sudden, I'm sitting there, and I get a Yahtzee. I'm like, oh, okay. And then I get another Yahtzee. And I'm like, oh, this is stupid. And then I get another Yahtzee. And then I got the fourth Yahtzee, and I'm like, okay, I'm pissed now. I just, like, threw the game, and I was like, you know what? I can't talk to you right now. I just had this random experience, and I was just annoyed. But that was, like, my little kick in the ass from my higher power. That's what it was, you know? I had this little spiritual awakening that said, you know what? don't talk shit because I'm really here, you know? And I was like, all right, I get it, you know, I get it. And that's when things were able to progress, you know, that's when I was able to move on, you know? Once I realized that it was there and there was this possibility of being restored to sanity, I could move on and I could turn things over and then I could take my inventory, you know? And I remember doing my step four and it was like crazy long and it was, you know, the whole, it was nuts. And, you know, I had to give it to a nun, and I was sitting there, and I was giving my fifth step to this nun, and I look over, and she's, like, dozing off. So me, being the addict I am, and it's all about me, I freak out on this nun, and I'm like, oh, my God, are you sleeping while I'm giving you my fifth step? Hello, I'm the most important person ever. Totally freak her out. She almost had a stroke, I swear, because she jumped like 50 feet, and I was like, okay, we'll put that on the next one. Anyway. But, you know, and then, yeah, so that was about it, you know. And I actually went through all my steps, and I continued to go through all my steps. You know, I got out of treatment, and I thought, you know, drinking wasn't all that much my thing, even though somebody had explained to me, well, you're kind of like 22 years old, and, you know, you got some drunken disorderlies in there and DWI, and I really thought that when I got out of treatment, things were going to be just like normal. You know, I didn't expect that I was going to be going to 12-step meetings. I didn't, you know, I didn't expect that, you know, Cocaine Anonymous was going to be, you know, the meaning of my choice. You know, I never expected that, you know, we were going to have a meeting called Silencing the Squirrels in Bay City, Wisconsin, you know. But I got out of treatment, and I got scared. I got really scared because I knew I had gotten this glimpse of something a little bit better and a little bit different in my life, you know. I was going to meetings at the Elks Club over in Minnesota, Red Wing, Minnesota. That's where I live, but I go up there, there's this just totally crazy lady that's up there, and she's like, hey, we're going to be starting a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, blah, blah, blah. Hey, come down to my 1981 Mustang on the corner of Plum Street and 4th Street, and here, I'll give you a bunch of pamphlets. So this woman completely assaults me with Cocaine Anonymous pamphlets, which is the reason that I'm here today, you know? And she went on to be my sponsor and one of the most prominent women in my life, you know. And, you know, it's kind of crazy because sometimes it doesn't feel like it's been that long, you know. But with the strength of my Creator, I mean, it'll be 6 years on April 18th for me, you know. And when I think about it, it doesn't seem like it's been that long. You know, for the first few years, my extent of Cocaine Anonymous was just the Red Wing, Twin Cities, you know, Bay City area. I had no clue that there was, like, this huge, you know, I didn't know that there was really anything past that, I guess, you know. I've taken some pretty hard knocks in recovery, you know. I've done all the things that people tell you not to do, you know, like get into a relationship, do all that stuff, you know. And for me, it doesn't really matter what's going on in my life, you know. If I'm working the program the way it's supposed to be worked, the way that it's set up to be worked, if I do what's suggested of me, you know, things go smoothly, no matter how much turmoil is in my life, you know. And I know that, you know, with the help of this program, I can stay sober through anything. I didn't understand what true powerlessness was. It actually took me 2 years into the, or 3 years into this program. I was on my third year sober. My dad had hepatitis C, went to the University of Minnesota for just a workup, and 4 surgeries, 2 days, and 250 units of blood because he was bleeding out internally. And the doctors finally came to me and my mom and said, there's nothing that we can do. You have to make a decision. You have to be the one to make this decision to stop everything or to keep working until he dies on the table. How do you make that choice? You know, how do you make that choice without the guilt and everything that goes on with it? I had to sit back and I had to put my selfishness aside because every part of me wanted to look at them and say, he never gave up on you. His heart's still beating. He's still breathing. Keep going. And I had to make that choice. I had to make that choice to stop all measures. And you want to talk about powerlessness. That threw my whole world into an out of control motion, you know. And part of you wants to run away from it, and part of you wants to go back out there, because if you're high, you don't have to think about that, you know. You don't have to live with that. And we made that decision, you know. We made that decision. And I remember calling my sponsor afterwards and not really knowing what to say. And her answering and knowing that it was, she was going to do everything to hold me up when I couldn't hold myself up. And I remember the drive back from St. Paul into Red Wing, and it was a 45-minute drive. And just thinking to myself that the reality of that did not happen, you know, that that was not real. And getting back to Red Wing, and it was a Friday, and the first thing I had to do was make funeral arrangements, and I never thought I would do that. You know, I never thought that it was going to be me making that decision to let my dad go, and I didn't think that I was going to have to come back and do that. And I remember going to the 10 o'clock, silencing the squirrel meeting, and sitting there, and not knowing anything to say to people. I had no explanations. You know, I just knew that if I showed back up at those tables that somebody was going to help me, you know, and that is an amazing feeling, you know. It's an amazing feeling to know that the rest of the world might not know how I feel, but somebody at these tables is going to have an experience that's going to help me through what I need to get through, you know. And to be able to go through that, and to be able to make it through that, and to be able to do it sober, and to actually be able to stand up with pride by my family at my dad's funeral, you know, and to be able to still stand by them today, because it's a very difficult thing to have to go through. You know, I remember being at a speaker meeting the month before my dad died, and this lady said, until you've been there, you have no clue. Talking about the same situation that I was going to be going through. And I remember sitting in that meeting and I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to ever have to do that. I don't ever want to be put into that predicament, into that situation. And there I was a month later into that very same situation. Had I never heard her story, who knows what would have happened. You know, these rooms give me that hope, you know, the experience, strength, and hope, you know, that's what it's all about, you know, the hope, faith, and courage, everything, you know. I've been able to walk through some pretty hard knocks in recovery, you know. I don't know if anything's going to compare to that day that I made that choice. I've still struggled with it. I struggle with it on and off. Sometimes when I'm really hard on myself, I feel like a murderer, you know. And and I worked through that, you know. I tried to really work through that, you know. It's now been 2 years since my dad passed away, and we've had some pretty, you know, the experiences in recovery never stop, you know. But I am so grateful for this program, that I had this program. If I was a normal person, I wouldn't have had that love and support, and I wouldn't have had those things. And it's just amazing to me. The miracles never stop. You know, somebody told me when I first came into the program, they said, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. You know, and I see that miracle happening every day in my life and in other people's lives. And it's a very good feeling. You know, I came down here last year, and I kind of came, I think it was on a whim last year, too. It's always kind of been, I don't really plan things out all that well. And, you know, I have five people with me, you know, or, well, five and four others, you know, with me from the Bay City meeting, you know. I have some really good friends that I've met in this program, better than any friends that I ever had out there using. You know, these are people that love me, that care about me, that want to support me no matter what, you know, and I'm so grateful for all of them, and I'm grateful for all of you. Like I said, it's, you know, it's been over 5 years since I've been sober, and it's going to be six, and you know, I never thought that when I came into this program and I walked through the doors of a 12-step meetings in Cocaine Anonymous, that I was going to be standing up here, almost 6 years later. That just was not in my scheme of my grasp of things. You know, I'm truly grateful. You know, I'm truly grateful. And I'm grateful for all of you, and I'm grateful to be able to be here today. Like I said, I have continued miracles every day in my life. You know, since I've been sober, I went back to school. I'm a cosmetologist. I'm a makeup artist. I work with five successful photographers in the Rochester area. I would have never done that using. I might have gone to school, but I wasn't getting very far. You know, I now have a career. You know, I'm a productive member of society, which is really cool for me, because I've actually had the same job for, 3 years now. I know, right? I never had that before, because I was like, you know, I just don't feel like going today. I'm really high. I think I'll just, you know, or I'd show up whenever I wanted to, you know, halfway through the day. All right, here I am. Yay. You know, so I have a career, you know. I do a lot with the I do a lot with the Native American community. I myself am German, Ojibwe, and Cherokee. And so I really like to, you know, keep my traditions to my heart and stuff like that. It's really important to me that that I help out with, like, the Native communities and things like that, you know. We have a bunch of kids out at the island which is down the road from my house, that are going to be the hosting drum at the powwow. And the guy that I was dating last year when I came here, for some reason I broke up with him and I got two kids out of this deal. Like, I didn't actually have them. They're 14 and 17, but they're at my house every other weekend. So I have two amazing girls, you know, that love me and trust me. And want to be with me, you know, and I think about that, and if I was using, they would have never wanted to hang out with me. You know, they're beautiful, they're both beautiful, they're traditional dancers, you know, and it's awesome to me. It's awesome to watch them grow, and it's really good to know that they have somebody that they can go to if things get rough for them, you know. And my 14-year-old found out that I was sitting at a meeting. She's like, you should have totally asked me to go. I wanted to go. I'm like, really? Are you okay? You know? But she actually likes to go to meetings and stuff like that, she's kind of the odd one anyway, but I love her. But no, you know, like I said, the miracles never stop. You know, with this program, there is no guarantee walking through the door, and there's no guarantee with anything that your life is going to be perfect the minute that you walk through these doors. However, you know, things do get better, you know, and things are, you know, 1,000 times better than when I was using. So I don't know. I'm totally grateful to be here, and I'm grateful that I was invited to speak. So thank you, Wadu.